भगवते वासुदेवाय। आम नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। आम नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 20, Pure Devotional Service, Text Number 2. Word meaning, Svarna Ashrama of the Varnashram system, Vikalpam, the variety of superior and inferior positions created by piety and sin. Cha and Patiloma, birth in a mixed family, wherein the father is inferior in social status to the mother. Anulomajam, birth in a mixed family in which the father is superior in social status to the mother. Dravya, material objects or possessions. Desha, the place. Vaya, one's age. Kalan, the time. Swargam, heaven. Narakam, hell. Eva, indeed. Cha, also. Varnashrama vikalpam cha. Pratilomanulomajam. Dravyadesha vayakalam. Swargam narakam eva cha. Varnashrama vikalpam cha, pratilomanulomajam, dravyadesha vayakalam, swargam narakam eva cha. Varnashrama vikalpam cha, pratilomanulomajam, dravyadesha vayakalam, swargam narakam eva cha. Just noticing, it doesn't seem like there's any verbs in this. That's part of it's almost like even our Bhagavatam verses, because they're in poetry, sometimes they're a little bit like sutras. We have to sort of fill in the blanks sometimes. It's just a list of things, basically. Translation. According to Vedic literature, the superior and inferior varieties found in the human social system, varnashrama, are due to pious and sinful modes of family planning. Thus, piety and sin are constant points of reference in the Vedic analysis of the components of a given situation, namely the material ingredients, place, age, and time. Indeed, the Vedas reveal the existence of material heaven and hell, which are certainly based on piety and sin. Purport by Srila Prabhupada's disciples. Pratiloma indicates the combination of a superior woman with an inferior man. For example, the Vaidehaka community consists of those born of a Shudra father and a Brahmana mother, whereas the Sutas are those born from a Kshatriya father and a Brahmana mother, or from a Shudra father and a Kshatriya mother. Anuloma indicates those born from a superior father and inferior mother. The Murdha Vasikta are those born of a Brahmin father and a Kshatriya mother. Ambushtas are those born from a Brahmin father and a Vaishya mother, and they often become medical men. Karuna indicates those born of a Vaishya father and Shudra mother, or of a Kshatriya father and Vaishya mother. That such mixing of castes is not very much appreciated in the Vedic culture is demonstrated in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna was very worried that the death of so many Kshatriyas on the battlefield would lead to the mixing of superior women with inferior men, and on those grounds he objected to fighting. In any case, the entire Vedic social system is based on distinguishing between piety and sin, and Sri Uddhava is encouraging the Lord to explain more elaborately his statement that one should transcend both piety and sin. Om Jnanatimanandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militamena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. This is verse 2 of the chapter. I want to go back to the previous verse. Help us get some context here. Sri Uddhava said, "My dear lotus-eyed Krishna, you are the Supreme Lord, and thus the Vedic literatures consisting of positive and negative injunctions constitute your order. Such literatures focus upon the good and bad qualities of work." Now Uddhava is going to speak, half a dozen or so verses before Krishna speaks. And pretty much everything Uddhava is going to say here in the context of these verses, today's verse, yesterday's verse, or last Friday's verse, and upcoming few verses, is in response to something Krishna said at the very end of the last chapter. At the end of the last chapter had a whole, 6 verses all packed together. And there are a list of all kinds of things that one should do to make spiritual advancement, basically. Things that human beings should do. And there were, then at the very end, Krishna said, "Thus I have elucidated all the matters about which you inquired. There is no need for a more elaborate description of these good and bad qualities." So he listed things you shouldn't do and things you should do. "Since to constantly see good and bad is itself a bad quality, the best quality is to transcend material good and evil." So after Krishna actually spent not only this last section of verses, but the whole chapter, he talked about varnashram and other things. So he was obviously speaking in the context of good and bad. You should do this, this is good for you, and don't do this, this is bad for you. Then at the end, he said, Krishna says, we should just transcend good and bad. So Uddhava, of course, he knows what Krishna is talking about. But for the sake of others, he's asking Krishna here, this series of verses, well, how can you say we shouldn't be interested in good and bad? The whole Vedas are about good and bad. Throughout the Vedas, we're told, do this, do that, don't do that, and so on. So these, and basically, Uddhava's essential question. The Vedas and Vedic civilization are about good and bad, so how can you say we can transcend good and bad? So he's saying it in different ways. So in this verse, today's verse, he's saying it in respect to the Varnashram system. Because, of course, what is the Varnashram system? It's about Vedic social order. So it's based in the Vedas as well. So what Uddhava is saying here is even our social system, which we follow, is based on the Vedas, and it makes distinctions between good and bad, especially in relationship to marriage. The marriage between different castes, some of them are considered good and some of them are considered bad, or pious and impious. These words are used interchangeably here, good and bad, or pious and impious. Actually, the Sanskrit are guna and dosha. Guna, which we know means modes, but it also means good. Sometimes it's often used as just the mode of goodness. So guna is qualities. It's also often translated as qualities, especially good qualities. And then dosha means faults. Kalaya dosha nidairaja. So in the Varnashram system, we see that some marriages are considered good, anuloma, and some are considered bad, pratiloma. So the root of this is loma. A loma, interestingly, means hair. So, loma, roma also. Just a little interesting aside. Sometimes the L and R seem to get mixed up in Sanskrit. Just like if you've ever noticed in the seventh canto, Prahlad is not called Prahlad, he's called Prahrad with an R. So roma and loma, they both mean hair. So the idea is, and prati means against, something that impedes, for example. And anu means favorable or following. You know, Prabhupada uses anu. Whenever a word comes up, when it's in having to do with instructions or hearing, or any kind of devotional service, whenever the word anu would come up, Prabhupada would always say, from a bona fide spiritual master in disciplic succession. In other words, following in the disciplic succession. So that's favorable. And prati means going against. I was saying it because the word loma is there, it's like going against the grain or going against the hair. It's like when you comb your hair back, you get some resistance. I'll tell you something. When I first was, it took me a while before, because I was in the Air Force and I was trying to get out. And it took a long time. And finally, one week, we were tired of hearing the Air Force to come and give me my discharge. So the temple president, Bhaktidas in San Francisco, he said, Bhakti Norm, I think it's time for you just to shave up. So I did. When I sat down, of course, I was basically a full-time devotee, but I was only coming on the weekends when I could. So I didn't know everything. So the devotee, I said, I want to shave up. And he said, so when he sat down to shave my head, he said, so do you want a back shave? And I paused for a minute. I don't know everything, but I didn't know they shaved their backs. So then I found out what a back shave is. It means going against the hair. When you shave your head, if you go with the hair, then you get, you know, most of it. But if you want to get a really bald look, then you go against the hair. So that's pratiloma, going against the hair. You get more resistance that way. So where did... Well, that's actually what got me out of the Air Force. It's a long story, but they came and took my picture. Actually, the secretary of the Air Force, my resignation was going up chain of command. It was already on the secretary of the Air Force's desk. And I would check into the office and find out what was going on with my discharge. And that morning, after I shaved up, I went into the office filled fully with justices of the brahmachari and shaved up. And I said, so what's happening with my discharge? And they said, it's been turned down by the Secretary of the Air Force. I was so upset, and this is a whole story, but I went to the general's office, my commander of the base, and I tried to get to see him. They wouldn't let me see him, but they took my picture. And then 3 days later, I got my honorable discharge. Sometimes you have to go against the grain. Right? There's some benefits sometimes. But anyway, we're talking about marriages here. I was trying to think of some analogy I could create with this, but I don't know. Maybe going against the grain makes you bald faster. If you have a pratiloma marriage, you bald earlier. So now we have this list. Yeah. Loma means hair. Yeah. What is that? Loma ja. What is that verse? Yasyaika nishvasita kalama tavalambya jivanti loma vilaja jagadandanata. From the hair holes of Mahavishnu, all the universes are emanating. So that's one place where the word appears. Loma. And then there's, of course, Roma. There's Roma Pad, which means hairy feet. I guess the sage had hairy feet. Roma Pad Rishi. Actually, a lot of interesting names. I know it's Ridhan Anamaraj. He always likes to say what the words mean in Sanskrit. And a lot of times, they're very interesting. You know. One of them he likes to point out, there's a Prabhupada disciple named Rambholu. Right? It means one who has beautiful thighs. He's like, well, how would anybody know? She's named after someone, but of course she's Rambholu Dasi. Anyway, so getting back to the verse here. So then we have this whole list, which I hope all of you have memorized, because it will be on the test. All of these different... Actually, I was thinking this morning when we read after Mangalarti, it's so nice, these little bite-sized nuggets we hear about the holy name. How Dhruva Maharaj, he was so stunned, he didn't know what to do, so didn't they say there he just chanted Hare Krishna? That's basically the idea. So I was thinking, we always talk about how death is going to be a test. So I was thinking, well, when the test comes, no matter what the question is, there's only one answer. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And you see, this is what the devotees do. They just offer their obeisances and they chant the holy names. So when you're freaking out, you don't know what's going to happen next, just chant the holy name. That's the solution. That's the answer to the test. So now, this whole list here, I tried to find more information on some of these, just to have more information. And, of course, we know what sutta, this word we're familiar with. First I'll mention, the only one I could find even was Ambashta's. But here, what does it say? Those born from Brahmin father and Vaishya mother. I found the word, but it didn't have anything to do with that. Actually, Ambashta means an elephant keeper. And Krishna says it when the elephant is got Kuvalayapita at the gate of Mathura. And Krishna is challenging him. He says, Ambashta, Ambashta. He begins with some shloka. It begins with twice Ambashta. And basically what he's saying, elephant keeper, elephant keeper. You better move that elephant or I'm going to do it for you, basically, is what he's saying. So that's Ambashta. But it doesn't seem, when I looked it up in the Sanskrit dictionary, I was thinking, well, maybe those who are from an Ambashta marriage, they end up being elephant keepers. But that didn't seem to be there. But in reference to the suttas, now again, what does it say a sutta? Those born from a Kshatriya father and a Brahmin mother. So we know Roma Harshan Sutta. We know the pastime of him being killed by Lord Balaram. And it's pointed out there that, actually a couple of things probably, so he actually shouldn't have been on the Vyasasana, but he was given that. The Brahmins put him there, so okay, he was there. But when he did something wrong, then it was understood, well, he's just a sutta anyway, so what do you expect? who are the suttas? Now the word sutta comes up often. Now his name, of course, is Roma Harshan Sutta. One thing I thought was interesting was, I thought, well, how do these, just like today in India, there's hundreds or maybe thousands of castes and subcastes. I think they call it the jati system. Isn't that what they talked about? So it's very, very complicated. So it seems like once you break the rule, then your whole lineage gets branded with that name. That seems to be, because we have Roma Harshan Sutta, and it had to do with his father and mother. Their marriage was Pratiloma. So he became Roma Harshan Sutta. Their family somehow just acquired that caste because of that marriage. And then the son, he's Roma Harshan Sutta, and his son, who is, we call him Sutta Goswami, but his name is actually Ugrashrava Sutta. That's his name. So he took the family name too. Now, of course, I don't know if they went around calling people by the way we use first name and last name. That's sort of a modern invention. But we know him that. We know him as Sutta Goswami, which is kind of interesting. He's been elevated. He has that Pratiloma caste name, but Goswami added to the end of it. Now the suttas, that word comes up often. First of all, we hear in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, where Vyasadeva is dividing up the different branches of the Vedas and assigning to different people. First of all, what did he do, actually? The Vedas, they were just kind of all merged together, all different parts of the Vedas, instructions for this and mantras for that, and you know, mantra, tantra, so on. It was just all mixed together. So he organized it. There's a verse in the end of the Bhagavatam that says it's like a king. He's got all these jewels, so he pulls out the diamonds and he pulls out the rubies and pulls out the sapphires and makes different four different stacks, basically, or five different stacks, because the fifth Veda is included. So that's actually where Romaharshan Sutta, he was given charge of the Puranas, which are the fifth Veda, Puranas and Itihasas. So quite a remarkable situation he was put into, or responsibility he was given. The Vyasadeva gave, now maybe he was a disciple, because the others I know were disciples of Vyasadeva. So Vyasadeva gave to his disciples different portions of the Vedas to oversee, or the Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva, and then the Puranas. So they were given responsibility for these. And Romaharshan Sutta was given responsibility for taking care of, protecting, and so on, the integrity of the Puranas. And also, he was reciting the Puranas. So what we find often is that, especially when there are big assemblies, like Prithu Maharaj's coronation, for example, or Krishna's arrival in this place or that, we have certain people who are reciting prayers. There are three categories that are always mentioned: the Suttas, the Magadhas, and the Vandis. This list comes up often: the Suttas, the Magadhas, and the Vandis. So the Suttas, they are the ones who recite the Puranas, from the Vedic literature especially. And the Magadhas, they recite the family history. Like if you're glorifying the king, the Magadhas will glorify the king and they'll say, oh, you're such a great king, and your great-grandfather was this king, and he did this exploit, and so on. That's what the Magadhas do. They're experts in the family histories. So kind of mundane what they recite. And then the Vandis, they offer prayers, which is easy to remember, because Vande Ham Sri Guru, or Vande Guru Sri Charanaravinda. So Vande, I offer my obeisances, I offer my prayers. So the Vandis, they offer prayers. So in any case, this is what the suttas do. The suttas recite the Puranas. So even though it's pratiloma, you can say that it's considered impious, or not exactly right, not good. He doesn't come from good parentage. Still, somehow, they're allowed to recite the Puranas. Now, I read somewhere, I forget where it was, or it may have been a class I heard by Gopi Puranadan Prabhu, who knew a lot about whole Vedic culture and history in the past and so on. Anyway, I heard that the suttas, and these three personalities, what they do, this may even be in the Bhagavatam in one purport, is done under the guidance of the Brahmanas. So what they're doing is very important for Vedic culture, and it's kind of a high position. They're the ones who are doing all this recitation and these big sacrifices. And coronations and those kinds of things. But they're doing it under the guidance of the Brahmanas. So they're sort of almost like proteges to the Brahmanas. They're doing this auspicious part of the ritual that's going on. So it's kind of a nice situation to be in, actually, to be a sutta. But even though it's described here as something not so good. So that's about it, about this whole list here. So again, going back to what is this all about? Good and bad is the bad. We're not concerned with that. The verse that mostly comes to mind in this respect comes from Chaitanya Charitamrita: Dvaite Bhadra Bhadra Gyan Sab Mano Dharma E Bhala E Manda E Sab Brahma. So this verse says, Dvaite, the duality of Bhadra Bhadra Gyan, knowledge of this is good and this is bad. Bhadra Bhadra, of course, means auspicious and inauspicious. E bhala, e manda, e sab brahma. To think this is good and this is bad, that's a brahma. Brahma means mistake. It's just a mistake. So Lord Chaitanya has spoken this, and the context was Sanatan Goswami was thinking of committing suicide because, you know, he went through the Jarikanda forest and he picked up some disease and he had sores all over his body. They were oozing, and Lord Chaitanya would embrace him. So Sanatan Goswami was so mortified by this, horrified by the idea that Lord Chaitanya was embracing him and getting this pus from his body onto his transcendental body. So he was thinking of going to go to Vrindavan. And Jagadananda Pandit encouraged him. And Sanatan told Lord Chaitanya this. And he said, Jagadananda has encouraged me to do this. And Lord Chaitanya was very upset. Who is this Jaga? He's just a young boy. Why are you listening to him? Actually, when I read this, Lord Chaitanya calls him Jaga. There's a little aside here. There's a lot of nicknames, actually, in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Just like Nittai comes from Nityananda. Gadadhar, his appearance day or disappearance day was yesterday. He's called Gadai sometimes. Ramai, that's Sri Ram. One of Srivas Thakur's brothers, one of them is called Sri Ram, and he's called also Ramai. So there's a lot of these I. So Jagadananda, Lord Chaitanya called him Jaga. So this Jaga is just a young boy. Why are you listening to him? So then Lord Chaitanya said, actually, with transcendental vision, I see your body in a transcendental way. So there's no problem. I don't have any problem with it. And besides, I'm a sannyasi, and even if I see materially, I shouldn't see good and bad. He said, there's good and bad, and then he quoted this verse. It's just a mistake. So of course, the question that Uddhava is asking here, well, there's no good and bad, and why are we hearing all about good and bad throughout the Vedas? Everything we do is based on good and bad, or pious and impious. So, what the basic explanation is, Lord Krishna here, in his response, he's going to talk about different sections of the Vedic literature in a general way, karma yoga, jnana yoga, and then bhakti. So outside of bhakti, there is these distinctions are generally made in lower stages, basically the lower stages of spiritual advancement when one's being trained in spiritual life. We do have to accept this is good and this is bad. And to set the foundation, you might say come to the mode of goodness, then from there we have a better opportunity to ultimately come to transcendence. But that's what we're aiming for ultimately. On the platform of Krishna consciousness, materially, you don't see good and bad. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, I remember the first time I read this. When I first read the Gita, of course it comes up early, where Krishna says, you will become indifferent to all that is to be heard and all that you have heard and will be heard. And I thought, wait a minute, every day I'm hearing about how we're supposed to hear so much. It's all about hearing. And now Krishna's saying you're going to become indifferent to it? Of course, you just have to look at the context. And what Krishna is talking about is the Vedas and their situation in the lower modes of material nature. And he's telling Arjuna, you have to transcend. You have to transcend this level of the Vedas that have to do with karmakanda and so on. So that's really what this is all about here. And Krishna will be discussing it very elaborately. And Uddhava here is basically laying out the question three or four different ways. This same basic idea. So our understanding, we get from our acharyas and from Srila Prabhupada ultimately, is that this whole material world, it's neither good nor bad in a sense, any more than a dream is. A dream, what is a dream? It comes and it goes and it fades away and has no ultimate significance in the context of reality and what is good or bad for us. So similarly, even if everything in this material world, actually, in that section in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is speaking about this, in one purport, Prabhupada quotes, I think it's Madhavendra Puri, where he says, I don't care about doing my, ablutions, and I don't care about my chanting my mantras and just all these things that I've done very strictly, because now I've transcended all of those things. We know, of course, also in the principle in the nectar devotion, that you have to follow the rules and regulations very carefully. But when you become very elevated, transcendental on the Swarup Siddhi, then you don't necessarily have to follow. Of course, the advanced devotees do it because they like to do these things, of course, because all, even our practices are all devotional service. But there's not that you have to do it, because naturally you're doing everything spontaneously in Krishna consciousness. So in that sense, all the rules and regulations don't apply so much. So that's the basic idea of this chapter. Actually, that's why it's called pure devotional service. In pure devotional service, in the highest level of pure devotional service, there's no consideration of these, what is good and what is bad in the context of material consciousness for the conditioned soul. So I'll read the translation again. According to Vedic literature, the superior and inferior varieties found in the human social system, varnashrama, are due to pious and sinful modes of family planning. This word, of course, family planning, is controversial today because it's a euphemism for abortion, actually. They say, come to our family planning clinic, you know. That's the plan. We'll keep you from having a family, killing your child in the womb. Thus, piety and sin are constant points of reference in the Vedic analysis of the components of a given situation. Actually, I wanted to mention this too. Maybe I should get through the translation first. Namely, the material ingredients, place, age, and time. I had a hard time with that sentence when I read it originally. Indeed, the Vedas reveal the existence of material heaven and hell, which are certainly based on piety and sin. Basically, the idea is that you consider good and bad and piety and impiety in our ordinary life or under the Vedic culture and in respect to these various things. So there, dravya, desha, vaya, and kala are mentioned here. So dravya means material ingredients. So some things, it's like you're going to have a fire sacrifice, so certain things are considered pure and you have them in the arena, and some things are impure. We have various stories of these demons polluting the sacrificial arena by passing stool and urine there and those kinds of things. So you don't want that. So that's dravya, that's bad. And then the place where you do things, actually consider, one time I came across a list where when you're out somewhere, you have to answer the call of nature. There's all kinds of rules about where you should and shouldn't do it. Not on the bank of a river, not in the sunshine. There's a bunch of them like that. So place is very important. Age, how old you are, you do certain things. Just like we know in the Varnashram system, brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. So these stages occur at different ages in a person's life. So you're supposed to do them in that order according to your age and not flip the order or whatever. That's considered not so good. And then time. Now we know devotees, they sometimes do prashnas when they want to do something. They want to know, what's the time? We're going to have a housewarming. What time should we do it on which day and so on. So these calculations, astronomical calculations, are there according to what is favorable and unfavorable. So that's the idea here. So Uddhava is saying, we're always trying to think what's pious or impious or auspicious or inauspicious. So then he also says, and ultimately, we're thinking about heaven and hell. How can you say we're not thinking about good and bad? If we're good, we go to heaven. If we're bad, we go to hell. So then you're saying we don't worry about all these things? So this is how he's framing his question, these different examples. All right. Anything? Yes, Prabhu.
I heard a class by Srila Prabhupada. It's called Transcendental Morality. He's talking about Arjuna fighting in the battle and the gopis giving their foot dust for Krishna's headache. And Prabhupada says that, never mind, the whole world goes to hell. If Krishna is satisfied, you're prepared to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, Prabhupada does. In fact, it comes up here also in one of the purports, the idea that there's really only one calculation, what's good or what's bad. It's what's pleasing to Krishna or displeasing to Krishna. That's how we calculate. And of course, that's a transcendental calculation that we're making there. Yes?
Hare Krishna, thank you, Prabhu, for making a little bit of a dry subject interesting. I have a question about the matching of Brahman and Brahman wife, or the mixing I'm wondering if it has to do with compatibility of the two. Would be better if they were similar in nature, according to the, you know, the ashram, the Varnan ashram there. Or it has to do with the diluting and the confusing of the stations in life and the propensities to engage in certain kind of activities in the world. You know, just looking at it from the Varnashram system, because Prabhupada said he wanted, that was his wish, 50% he did not do. So I'm always thinking about how to apply that, even we're not going to start big Varnashram whole society, but we can be in our minds understanding these things, and if we're guiding others or we're addressing society, we can have this in our mind, what works, you know, what's important to consider in people's lives. So the question about compatibility, or is it just the dilution of the...
One thing that seems to be implied here, an overriding rule, is that anuloma, as when the husband is in a superior caste to the wife, and patiloma is when he's inferior to the caste. So what is implied here is that, at least in Vedic culture, the husband is in a superior position. So if the castes are reversed, that's considered to be not very favorable. Now, there, you would think also that it would have something to do with psychology, because a Kshatriya woman has a certain nature to her, and a Brahmin man has a certain nature to him. So, but that's actually considered anuloma if the husband is a Brahmin and the wife is a Kshatriya. So it seems like it has more to do with their social status, and apparently things were so strict in those in these Vedic times that, you know, people tend to think a certain way and associate with these. When I read this, I think, boy, it's so heavy. They're really sticklers for these things, aren't they? Because there's another whole side to this. The last verse in the 7th chapter, the 7th canto, Narada Muni is speaking. That's yet. Yatraya lakshanam proktam pungso varnabhya vanchikam yadanyatrapi dishyeva tattinaiva nirdishe. So Narada Muni says, actually it doesn't matter what family you're born in, your caste should be determined according to your qualifications. Which doesn't seem at all like what we read about today. It doesn't seem like as a practical matter this was generally done. Although there are quite a few examples of it, just like the sons of Rishabhdev. Most of them became Brahmanas. He was a Kshatriya, and most of them were Brahmanas. So there are examples, and Prabhupada would always jump on it and say, here's an example how it's not by birth. But it does seem that generally it's by birth, and it seems the exception was that it was sometimes not by birth. Now, as far as today, we're all Varna Sankara. We're all mixed up. Actually, this word Sankara, Prabhupada would, how would Prabhupada say? Unwanted population. He would translate generally, unwanted population. But Sankara just means mixed. It means to mix up. So when you're when the things are mixed up, so that's the way it is today. It's really, it's a hodgepodge. It's just a complete mix. So we're all outside, so if we're going to do our calculations on compatibility, we do it some other way. And of course devotees do that in marriages. They do astrological charts generally. Whether the prospective bride and groom always follow the recommendations is another thing, but there is that does go on even in our society. So yeah, a lot of times applying the principles of these former times is sometimes difficult. Where's the microphone? Who's closest to it? Pranavindapur?
I was thinking Lord Krishna's personal life. Both are applicable in a sense.
Yeah, he got criticized for it. By Shishupal, anyway. We don't know if you're a Kshatriya or a Vaishya or what.
I mean, Shishupal is right in one sense. Sanatan Goswami Pad gives the genealogy of Krishna. That King Devamir had two wives. One was Kshatriya. He was a Kshatriya. And one was a Vaishya. So from Vaishya come Prajanna Maharaj, whose son is Nanda Maharaj. So Anuloma is there in Krishna's life, because Nanda Maharaj's son is him. But then his mother, Yashoda, who is a daughter of Soghosh, they're from Kayastha, upper class. so superior, you can say, towards the Vaishya, who is Nanda Maharaj. So Anuloma, I mean, Pratiloma, both are there in Krishna's life. But I was thinking, like, in the compatibility, what made Mother Yashoda to marry Nanda Baba, the Ghatana, Ghatak, the astrologer, who said, oh, this is the perfect match. And that was the cause. So compatibility is there, even though Mother Yashoda's position was higher than Nanda Baba. So I think both are reconciled.
Chimashmiko? This point about transcendental morality that was brought up. So I guess the real issue is how to determine what's pleasing to Krishna. I mean, it's easy when you're just following this is good and that is bad, but understanding what's actually the most pleasing to him, it's more of an internal realization that comes about as one advances.
Well, that's definitely part of it. I always like, there's one letter Prabhupada wrote to Hansaduta many years ago, and he was trying to figure out what to do. And Prabhupada wrote in the letter, you pray to Krishna, he'll tell you what to do. I thought, wow, it's giving a lot of, you know, credit. We can accept guidance from Krishna in that way. So that's certainly part of it. And the other thing is, of course, we consult with others. And, you know, there's always a question of, you know, if you're going to do something that seems a little, you color outside the lines a little bit, then you have to be really careful. Especially the more extreme it seems, then you have to be extremely careful and consult with others. And of course, getting back to this Anu, we consult the Parampara, we consult the spiritual master and whoever, other Vaishnavas to get some guidance. And of course, generally, in the Vaishnavas, it's not that because I'm transcendental now I can do anything I want. Generally, the Vaishnava, because his heart is soft, he loves Krishna, he loves humanity, and he's going to naturally follow the rules. Just like Arjuna, that we get this whole, it's almost like a paradox, Arjuna. Well, he was a Vaishnava, so his heart was melting, he didn't want to do it. But then, well, he was supposed to do it. It's almost like going against his Vaishnava nature. But then he had the Kshatriya nature too. But naturally, and Prabhupada gives him credit for that, naturally, because he was a Vaishnava, he was feeling compassion. So naturally, the devotee wants to act in a moral way, wants to follow the rules. It just comes natural. So if there's some reason to deviate from that somewhat, then it has to be done very carefully with consultation and prayer. Yeah.
One point, I'm the Bhad Bhagavad Gita class for Prabhupada in 74, where Prabhupada describes how a king has many servants and their business is to please the king. And then he goes in and he says, and our business is to please Krishna. And when he's pleased, then we're pleased. So that's one intimacy, you know, that we experience transcendental bliss, reciprocation from Krishna. But it's oftentimes after the fact, right? You know, so...
Yeah.
But it seems like you get a trajectory, and so that you can analyze it on the basis of, well, this pleased him before, so if I do it again, yeah, I'm on the right track.
Yeah, probably did say we have to use our intelligence, so sometimes we just have to do our best. Dharma Rajpuru?
Yes, sir. A couple of things. One, you know, you were talking about your military discharge. So remember the story with Krishna Kripa Prabhu. He was called for jury duty here. So he turned up with his shaved head, tilak, and dhoti and kurta. So when he turned up there, they look at him and said, well, you don't have to be here. You can go back home. So he got released from that. You know, you were talking about Rishabhdev and his sons. They became Brahmanas. So, is it from one angle we can see that because of Rishabhdev's teachings to them, that because they were all, those teachings were all transcendental and Brahmanical teachings? So
that could be. They were certainly trained by their father, and their father was an incarnation of God, so that might have had something to do with it.
Yeah. And like many times when Srila Prabhupada would talk about the same argument you gave about
You know, they, like, Brahmanas can come from, you know, from Brahminical parents, mainly because the opportunity is there. Just like if the father is a doctor, there's a good chance that the child has that opportunity because of, you know, that facility is there. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they would take up that path. So one cannot become qualified just due to birth. But you know, the other side got to be there.
Prabhupada used to sometimes compliment the parents when he would meet with the devotee and his parents, her parents. He would say, oh, the son is good or the daughter is good, therefore the parents are good. So I don't know if he was just doing that to flatter them, or he was, I don't think he was necessarily. He was pointing out the reality. If you have good parents, especially if they train their children, then the result is that they turn out well. So that, certainly training is part of the qualities that come out and show themselves in adult life. Yes. Oh, here. Go over here, Madhumati.
You were mentioning about Sutta Goswami, or the suttas took over the teaching of the Puranas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about the Puranas specifically, that how, in one sense, they're the people who study the Vedas, they don't even consider, you know, the Puranas as Vedas, you know, or it's considered the fifth Veda. And I was thinking how the Goswamis actually, they seem to quote all Puranas for, you know, for the Praman, they quote Praman, Puranas. My question was, do the Goswamis quote the other Vedas, or is basically for the Praman they quote?
They do. Now, of course, Lord Chaitanya set the standard. He also quoted the Bhagavatam more than anything else.
Yeah.
And then Jiva Goswami, who's the main philosopher among the Goswamis, his Tapasandarbha is for establishing the Srimad Bhagavatam. And he gives a whole argument about why the Puranas. One thing is that this word Purana, it comes from Purana, which means to complete. And they're, so the you really can't understand the Vedas without the Puranas. And of the Puranas, the Amala Purana is the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, we do find in Jiva Goswami, in his commentaries, or his Sandarbhas, that he does quote the Vedas, but not extensively. His main evidence is the Bhagavatam. But he does. There are certain verses especially that come up repeatedly. And what was I reading recently? I forget, it was a commentary on something. Anyway, one of our acharyas was saying, oh, I know what it was. It was Baladeva Vidyabhushana's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And in one purport, he says, we must refer to this Upanishad, the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. Yeah. So as far as I know, among scholars, they don't necessarily accept the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. But Baladeva Vidyabhushan is saying emphatically, we accept it. And if you really want to know the truth, read the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. So what is the Gopal Tapani Upanishad? It's all about Krishna directly. Krishna is Satchidananda Vigraha and so on. It's very specifically about Krishna. And a lot of it is about one of the Gayatri Mantras. It's about praising Krishna, glorifying Krishna. So our acharyas, when they quote the Upanishad, that's one they like to quote. There are certain verses within it also, in the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. Now, otherwise, the Upanishads, one reason we don't is because what is our path? We're on the path of bhakti. And the Upanishads are, and of course, the Vedas primarily are about karmakanda, and then the Upanishads are about jnanakanda more. And then bhakti, not so much, you know. That's why we have Narada Bhakti Sutras, and we have Narada Pancharatra. We have Narada is our guy. Narada, what you read, it's interesting how Narada is always coming on the scene in the Bhagavatam. And Narada is no holds barred. He just preaches bhakti straight on. You know how he got in trouble with Daksha, because why are you wasting your time? You want to have children and get entangled in, you know, he's telling the Haryashvas and the Savalashvas, just transcend it. Just become devotees, basically. Just shave up. Just shave up. Move into the temple. Narada, that's his approach every time. He doesn't. doesn't get into Gyanakanda or Karmakanda. It's always bhakti. Because he's bhakti personified, basically. That's of the different sons of Brahma. He embodies devotional service. So it's like he's a one-trick pony. He can only talk about bhakti. That's what he does. He talks about bhakti. So it's, in other words, so we quote Narada Muni, we quote the Puranas, we quote the Mahajans, all of those who are promoting bhakti. It's almost like what we're going to hear about in this chapter here. Why don't waste your time with Gyanakanda and so on. The Upanishads, okay, they're there for a reason, but if you want to get the real straight story, study the Puranas, especially Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavata Gita. I always want to point out in this song, Hari Harai Ramakrishna, it doesn't say Bhagavad Gita, it says Bhagavat Gita. So Bhagavatam and Gita is what it says. Prabhupada usually, when he would say, and in the Bhagavat it is said, he usually wouldn't say Srimad Bhagavatam. He would almost always say, in the Bhagavat it is said. That's what it says in that song, Bhagavat and Gita. Anyway, are we getting late? Okay, one more question back there. Go ahead.
I was thinking about the question, is this pratyaloma and anuloma about compatibility? And it is said in the Kardama and Devahuti pastimes, yata uchi yata shila, there should be a same lean and speed, or a same kind of taste and character for the husband and wife. But logically, the pratyaloma anuloma can't be about compatibility, because the favorable circumstance there is not equality between the two. It's that the husband's a little bit higher, or much higher. And I was hearing a tape from Srila Prabhupada recently, and he was explaining how without a Vaishnava husband, it's not possible for women to go beyond the modes of passion and ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll end there. Actually, this idea of compatibility, as you were saying, I was thinking, it may not be compatible exactly, because it's not considered equal in the Vedic context. It's compatible, we think, on the same level, but it's conducive to a happy marriage for the husband to be in a higher position. So maybe not compatible, but it's conducive to their material and their spiritual life. That's why it's promoted. All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.